A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Political Party Podcast. This one features Rory Palmer, former Labour MEP for the East Midlands. I first met Rory about 20 years ago, maybe even more than 20 years ago. When I first joined the Labour Party in Nottingham and I'd go to these events across the East Midlands, Rory was like a rising star even then and was vocal and was passionate. And it's been amazing watching him then go on and have a distinguished career in politics through local government and then in the European Parliament. And on the final day of the European Parliament, Rory's the one who had the scarves made that you'll have seen so many of the British members of the European Parliament wearing on those emotional scenes in that final day. First of all, I should say, thanks to everyone who's bought a ticket to the tour. The tour continues this week on the 20th of February, Thursday the 20th of February, which, when you hear this, is tonight at the Crewe Lyceum. Lyceum, that place, you know the one. On Friday night in Leicester, on the 21st of February, I'm at the Sue Townsend Theatre. On the 5th of March, I'm at the Darlington Hullabaloo. On the 6th of March, I'm at the Hexham Queen's Hall. On the 7th of March, the Bedford Quarry. On the 10th of March, the South Bank Centre in London. On the 14th of March, Maidenhead, Norden Farm. On the 18th of March, I'm at Leeds Hyde Park Book Club. On the 19th of March, York at the Crescent. On the 20th of March, Alnwick Playhouse. The 22nd of March, Southend, the studio. And on the 23rd of March, Cambridge Junction. There's loads more. I mention those because a few of them are close to selling out. They sold very well, which is very nice. But what I mean is, hurry up and buy a ticket if you want to go to those ones. You can get tickets for all those shows through my website, mattford.com/live. You can also buy tickets to future political parties now. I don't know whether you follow me on social media or not, but the next three guests for the live shows, so at the end of February, it's going to be Rebecca Long-Bailey. At the end of March, it's going to be Jeremy Hunt. And at the end of April, it's going to be Amber Rudd. Now, those shows have already sold out, but if you follow me on Twitter, at Matt Ford, and follow the other Palace, the venue on Twitter, sometimes on the day, people can't go or they get returns or whatever. And usually on the day, there's a couple of tickets floating around. And I know these ones sell out so far in advance, it's very frustrating. But if you follow us on the day, you probably stand a decent chance of being able to get in. So there you go. Very excited about those future guests and about some amazing future weekly ones. But let's crack on with today's episode with Rory Palmer. This is a real treat. This is so much insight into the role of an MEP, Britain's departure from the European Union, being a Labour politician over the last few years. This is just everything you would want us to cover is covered, and maybe a little bit more as well. But we begin by talking about the emotion of that final day of the UK being in the European Union.
It was an incredibly emotional day, and the footage you saw was, the few minutes immediately after the vote, after the European Parliament had voted to approve the withdrawal agreement. That was the final sort of formal stage of that agreement, the formalisation of us leaving the European Union. That emotion had been building for weeks. It had been an incredibly long goodbye. And I sort of set this in a bit of context. For 2 or 3 weeks, you would bump into colleagues in the European Parliament from all member states, some from our own political group, many from other political groups as well. They would shake your hand with a nod of despair. They would embrace you in hugs. This was 2 weeks before that vote. They were just, you know, utter despair, sharing our sadness, saying, you know, is there nothing else that can be done to sort of avert this, to stop this, to change the course of events? The reality is, as soon as we saw the general election result in December, we knew that's what was going to happen that last week in January. The morning of the vote, though, the Socialists and Democrats group, which is our political group in the European Parliament, which Labour MEPs are part of, along with our sister parties from the other member states, had held an incredibly emotional farewell event with some very moving speeches, looking back on the 40-odd years of Labour's contribution in the European Parliament. Yeah. And you look at that list of Labour MEPs from years gone by, some real legends of our movement, great names, people who made immense contributions. So it was a very emotional day. We then went into the Parliament chamber for the debate. We didn't really know what tone that debate was going to be. You know, we knew Nigel Farage was going to stand up and make a contribution. We didn't know if it was going to be the predictable sort of nonsense that he normally presents the Parliament with. It was. It could have been different. He could have chosen to take a much more somber, dignified tone. Perhaps I was being somewhat too optimistic on that front. But then, you know, we went through about 2.5 hours of debate. The vote happened very quickly. And then, yeah, there's the singing afterwards, Auld Lang Syne, and just lots of emotion. And, you know, the interesting thing is, there's all these photos of me crying. I've never cried in public before. Yeah. And if you speak to people, speak to my own family, and if I mind anyone else, one of the things that's often levelled at me is that I never show emotion. I never show emotion. So I may have overcompensated a little bit in the full view of Europe's media. But what happened was, it was incredibly emotional. The emotion had built for weeks. It had built through that, you know, through the course of that day. And what happened was, it had been pre-planned, the singing of Auld Lang Syne. A German Green Party MEP, Terry Reinke, had sort of planned that. Yeah. We had sheets with the lyrics on. But even then, he didn't quite know if it was going to happen or not. You need quite a few good singers to stand up in the European Parliament chamber, which is a huge space. It's almost like an arena. It's huge. To make that work, people did. But then I looked across the aisle, and a German MEP, Katarina Barley, was in tears, looked at me, embraced me, and that's the point at which I went. And what had happened was, we normally, as a small team of 10 Labour MEPs at the end, we normally sat sort of here and there right across the chamber. There's a set seating plan. It's alphabetical. I'm normally on row Z, sort of way back in the stall somewhere. But for this occasion, the socialist group, the whips, the party managers there, changed the seating plan. So we were sat as a group at the front of 10. That, again, added to the occasion, added to the emotion. And then, you know, walking out of the chamber, everyone, if I'm honest, was in bits. And it wasn't, we all have our personal stories, our personal reflections on this, but I'm still upset now. I'm sad about this for the country. I'm just a tiny, insignificant footnote in all of this compared to what's happened to our country.
So do you think, had you not seen that German MEP cry, you might not have been moved to tears? Was it that, or were you just ready to go and that was the thing that pushed you over the edge?
I honestly don't know. We'd all shed a few tears in the morning at the socialist group event, because that was our political family. That was a more sort of intimate, there were still hundreds of people there. But that was, I suppose, the more special event, given it was our own political family, our closest colleagues, if you like, in the Parliament, the people we've worked closest with, the people we are good friends with through our work and our time in Brussels. I don't know. I just know that emotion had been building over a number of weeks and just intensified. And the whole week had been strange, because it was this combination of three things, that the sort of the politics of this, and knowing we're going to be part of this big, momentous piece of political theatre around the vote and our final days in the European Union. At the other end of the spectrum, just the trivial nature of this, of packing boxes and winding up last bits of work and all that sort of stuff. And then in the middle of all that is just the human part of this as well, and all the emotion and saying goodbye to friends and colleagues, trying to help my own staff in Brussels and in the UK move on to new jobs as well. So there's just all these different dimensions, which, you know, I guess much of it is hidden from public view. People don't really necessarily notice what MEPs are doing. It's interesting, these past few weeks since Brexit, I probably spent more time talking about what MEPs from the UK did than I sort of did when we were actually there doing the job.
So when you became an MEP, not at election time, you were on the list system. Glenys Wilmot was elected ahead of you. She stands down. So then in 2017, you become an MEP. I mean, was that a sort of positive change? Did you think, oh, well, that's great, I finally get to go there? Or did you think, oh, actually, I'd got over not getting elected and I'd sort of emotionally moved on from that?
Yeah, it's a good question, because it was a strange time. Glenys retired, and Glenys Wilmot did a phenomenal job for Labour. She was the leader of Labour's MEP. She was chair of the NEC at a very difficult time for the Labour Party. Very good friend of mine. She decided to retire. And at this point, we were actually a few months after the trigger of Article 50. So I knew if I went to the European Parliament at that point, it was on a very short-term contract, so to speak. But I decided I want to do it. I'd stood in the elections in 2014. I decided that, you know, I felt Labour should be a strong voice in the European Parliament. Our country should be a strong voice, have a strong leading role in the European Union. I know the referendum had happened, but those of us who believe in that still felt there was a fight to be fought and a cause that we could continue to believe in. And we did. And I went to the European Parliament expecting to be there for, I think, 16, 17 months and was there longer. We 29th of March came and went, then the April Brexit date came and went, then October last year came and went. We had the European elections as the interim as well when I was re-elected in a very strange set of elections. So it's been, just in two or so years, it's been an incredible roller coaster for me. For my colleagues who've been there for a long, long time, it must have been, well, I know it's been incredibly testing at a, not just a political level, but an emotional level as well.
At the 2019 European Parliament elections, you were elected alongside a sort of glut of Brexit Party MEPs, including Annunciata Rees-Mogg, and her deep connections to the region of the East Midlands, of course, reflected in that. What is the relationship, or what was your relationship like when you're in, you know, you're sent as a cohort from the UK, you'll obviously then have your ideological divisions, and then you're within the groups, the different groupings within the European Parliament. Is there any sort of relationship with the more Eurosceptic elements of the UK, you know, members of the European Parliament?
Well, not really, because, you know, the bulk of our work as MEPs is done through the legislative committees, and because, you know, the Brexit Party MEPs, the Eurosceptics, just vote against everything as a matter of principle, strange principle in my view, you don't really end up having conversations with them about, you know, will you back this amendment? Will you support this initiative that I'm trying to do? And you do spend a lot of time working with MEPs from outside your own political family. So, you know, if I wanted to get an amendment through on something I was working on the Environment Committee, I could only do that by reaching out to the Liberals or the Greens, for example, or the centre-right groups. You know, the Brexit lot just don't sort of engage in that way. You would see them around the place now and again, but, you know, I haven't spent a great deal of time with them.
And what's the dynamic like in these European institutions, particularly the Parliament, where not every MEP is signed up to the European project? Other countries send their Eurosceptics there. Mm. They all sit together in different groups. Does the tone feel quite divided, or is there a sense that, on the whole, most members of the European Parliament are signed up to the European project at some level?
Yeah, absolutely. So it does feel that the, you know, the Eurosceptics are often trying to be heard. I think that's why they are deliberately, you know, provocative, theatrical sometimes in some of their contributions in the Parliament, because they know they're there, you know, as a minority in number compared to the vast majority, the vast majority of MEPs, but also the wider sort of community of Brussels in the institutions, which, as you say, is clearly bought into and committed to the European project to one extent or another. There's always that commonality, whereas the Eurosceptics are clearly railing against that, although, of course, more Eurosceptics have been elected to the Parliament over the years, but they find themselves in a fight for airtime, if you like. They sometimes win that fight and get perhaps a disproportionate amount of airtime through what they say and how they say it.
And what's the reaction on behalf of the majority of members of that Parliament and the leaders within those European institutions, particularly towards the British Eurosceptics? Are the British Eurosceptics there the most vocal and the most prominent because of Farage and maybe because of the numbers?
I would say so, yes. For the numbers, because Nigel Farage has a profile. He'd been there a long time, for sure. And of course, the Brexit Party, after the European elections in 2019, 29 of them, they were the biggest single party group in the Parliament. So they were noticeable when they sat there, you know, with the flags and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, you'll have seen it in the final debate. In fact, several prominent MEPs would reference the fact that they would miss the vast majority of MEPs from the United Kingdom, not necessarily all MEPs from the United Kingdom.
And how much of the noise and the behaviour, and I don't necessarily mean that in a negative way, of the Eurosceptics, has, do you think, affected Britain's relationship within those European institutions with our European neighbours? Did people say, oh, God, what is it with you lot? Or would they say, oh, we have these problems as well, or we have these differences as well?
No, I think there's a recognition that there's a vein of Euroscepticism and there's people been elected to speak for that and to represent that. I think, you know, I think about some of the contributions I've heard, you know, Brexit Party MEPs, UKIP MEPs before that, and indeed Eurosceptic MEPs from other member states make. I think they sort of make it very easy for their views to be dismissed through the way they make their points, actually. It's very difficult to engage in any sort of meaningful debate sometimes. They're there to rabble rouse, to be a distraction, to get attention. And if I'm honest, you know, when I've sat in meetings with Michel Barnier and, you know, these very serious people, they don't take any notice of them, to be honest. They really don't.
That can often be perceived as them not taking notice of Britain. I mean, do you think there's any truth to the fact that Britain is kind of was seen as an awkward member of the group, a kind of a country to be tolerated?
No, actually. I might have thought that once, actually, but I don't now. Having experienced these last 2 years or so, there is a huge amount of regard for the contribution the UK has made on many different levels in the EU through heads of state, through the European Council, and also through the Parliament, and indeed the huge number of Brits who work in the Commission, who work across institutions at an official level, huge amount of regard for the talent, the commitment, the intelligence that we brought to those institutions. And actually, what that huge amount of respect turned into a very real affection in those final few days and weeks, actually. And I think that added to the whole sort of emotional layers of this as well. There's most MEPs that I've spent time with and spoken to from other member states know a huge amount about the political system and the politics of our country. They look at the UK media, they look at our newspapers, they followed the twists and turns of Brexit since 2016 in huge detail, in real granular detail. And I think from that come, you know, that affection, that understanding, you know, genuine understanding of our politics, actually. So no, I don't think there's a frustration about us. I think there's a genuine sadness that we're not there anymore.
Did you experience anything during your time as a member of the European Parliament or see any processes that made you think, I can see why people get frustrated with the European project, with the institutions? They are bureaucratic, they are slow, it is hard to make a point. Maybe there is some positive to leaving.
No, I didn't say anything. There's no positives to leaving, in my view. But in terms of frustrations with the system, yes. But I've also said the same about local government here. I spent 10 years in local government here, 10 years as a councillor, and probably many of the things I moaned about then, I've probably moaned about in the European Parliament. And if you're a politician who's determined to do your bit to advance progressive, positive change, then sometimes you will find yourselves instinctively frustrated by the slowness or the cumbersomeness of a system or the bureaucracy. So yes, for sure, there were times when I was frustrated, but in terms of what we are not part of now, the fact that we have lost so much influence, so much global reach, you know, my sort of little trivial concerns about the length of time it takes to get an amendment tabled or get an answer to a parliamentary question, then that's just trivial nonsense compared to what we've lost as a country.
What about the dynamic within the European Union then, particularly when it comes to countries that are in the euro and that aren't? And that was always seen as perhaps a problem for the United Kingdom, that we were only going to have so much influence because we hadn't signed up to the currency, and that at the heart of the European Union, there is this desire for ever closer union. Now, something David Cameron perhaps doesn't get any credit for, did negotiate an end to ever closer union for the United Kingdom. But having sat at the heart of it for the past 3 or so years, do you still get the sense that truth is still there, that really at its heart, the European Union wants to continue to centralise in some way, ever closer union, and perhaps maybe not a European super state, but add to the powers that Europe has over individual nations?
There's certainly people there, certainly prominent figures there who do articulate ideas and a vision along those lines. But there's also, I think, the vast majority of people that I've heard speak there and listen to recognise that the long-term health, future and viability of the European Union is going to ultimately rest on the correct balance between, you know, national sovereignty and the role of national parliaments and member states and the European Union. And if you think about the big issues we are facing now, some of the issues I was working on as a member of the Environment Committee until a few weeks ago, the climate crisis, climate change, where are the big conversations going to happen on that issue? Are they going to happen in Westminster, that's actually about to disappear into just the next phase of all consuming Brexit discussions? Or are they going to happen on the European level or a broader international level? They're going to happen at a European level. We're not part of those conversations anymore. And those who sort of drive this idea of a super state and the sort of erosion of the power and the influence of national parliaments actually weaken, in my view, the viability of the European Union. So it ultimately comes down to that balance between member states, national governments, national parliaments and the EU. And I think that, you know, getting that balance right will be key to the EU's future.
But did you get a feeling that there was a direction of travel, that Brexit perhaps hadn't checked the desire for an ever closer union from those who truly believe in the European project? Or are these views so disparate and different across such a mass of a political class that really they're almost statistically, you know, could be disregarded?
I mean, and you put that in the context of the Brexit question and what's happened here. It comes down to, you know, what do we feel people had in their minds when they cast their votes? And I don't recall a big debate going on here about, you know, the role of the European Union and whether the European Union was going to sort of have enhanced powers in the future. And, you know, come on, we know the debate wasn't that. Maybe had we had that more nuanced debate about our role in a reformed European Union going forward, perhaps, you know, would the result have been different? I don't know, but I know that debate in 2016 wasn't that.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, I voted Remain, I still think we should have stayed, but I would never want to get into a position where, because I'm a Remainer, that I overlook the problems that are at the heart of the European Union. So I guess I'm just trying to, in a way, find some positives to leaving, or at least, I mean, maybe there aren't. Maybe it's something that you haven't observed. But even for Remainers, there was a concern. And of course, it wasn't really part of the referendum campaign. But just from a democratic point of view, that if we weren't in the euro, and I think most people in Britain take the view that that's a good thing, we wouldn't want to ever join. Mm. And obviously, that's a debate that may play out in Scotland in the next few years about whether they join. But that actually there were some benefits to not being an awkward member of the family, but that maybe some Remainers have disparagingly looked at particularly conservative instincts on Europe, and in retrospect, perhaps some of those were quite good.
Look, the fact that we had the settlement that we had, we weren't in the euro, and we had a favourable position in terms of the budget.
Yeah.
It just makes me even more angry, the fact that, you know, all that's been sort of squandered away. Squandered away for what? You know, some might see us as a sort of awkward sort of relative, the awkward sort of member of the family. But even, you know, thinking about those final few weeks and months, most people I spoke to in the Parliament and across Brussels, across the institutions, would have been prepared to tolerate whatever level of awkwardness we were going to sort of amplify inside the tent over us not being in the tent at all. To be honest, I think that gets lost from the debate here and a lot of the coverage here, just how much of a regrettable and sad episode this has been for the EU, as much as it has been for Remainers and pro-EU people here.
Perceptions about individuals can really suffer with a bit of distance. So I just wonder what your impression was of some of the leading figures. I would presume Donald Tusk is quite an impressive guy.
Very much so. Clearly, we come from different political places in terms of our political groups and our political backgrounds. But seeing Donald Tusk command the audience of the European Parliament, 751 MEPs, you know, it's a big Parliament. And when he spoke in the Parliament, reporting back from some of those big momentous European Council meetings through the Brexit process. Yeah, he's a formidable politician, there's no doubt about it, and I have a huge amount of respect for him. He's and him not being in that role, I think he's going to be, no disrespect to Charles Michael, who's replaced him, but he's going to be a big loss to the European Union's voice on the global stage, I think.
Similarly, Michel Barnier seems like an impressive individual.
Yeah, Michel Barnier is probably of the sort of household names, if you like, of EU politics. Barnier is the one I've been able to spend most time with in terms of him briefing our political group, both in, you know, some one-to-one conversations and meetings as well. He's clearly a very, very smart, astute negotiator, but an incredibly sincere, decent person. One of the most sincere, decent people I've met in politics. If I was to give an example, the week after the general election in December, we were in the Strasbourg Parliament that week, and I was just having a coffee in the coffee bar between meetings, and he was sat at the next table with his advisors, his entourage, and he sort of glanced across. He saw I was there, and he probably guessed what me as a pro-European UK MEP was feeling that week. That general election result was the moment we knew Brexit was unavoidable. It was definitely going to happen. And he came over. Didn't have to. Came over. Very nice chat. Offered a few bits of advice and was just very, very nice about it. And he's a very powerful, very busy person. He didn't have to do that. You know, he really didn't. But that is just an example, I feel, of someone who is, you know, as I said, a very astute, very, very serious politician doing a very, very serious job, but also a very, very sincere, decent man as well.
What about Jean-Claude Juncker?
Didn't meet Jean-Claude Juncker that many times, although I did. There was one particular moment at the start of a parliamentary sitting when everyone was milling about at the beginning. He was sort of down at the front and Tusk was there as well. And I just thought, you know, might not ever get another chance. So I went to get my selfie with Donald Tusk. I thought, well, you know, these are historic moments. So I'm get my selfie with Donald Tusk. And all of a sudden between my phone and me and Donald Tusk is this hand appears. So on my phone, I've got this close up photo of some palm of someone's hand, and it was Jean-Claude Juncker who just appeared, and in a sort of a bit of EU multi-institution banter, decided to interrupt our selfie, and this was captured. I think it was Italian TV filmed this, and they did a thing on it. And before you know, I had messages from people saying, "Rory, do you know you're on telly doing a selfie with Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker? What on earth's going on?" And so yeah, it's one of those random moments where I sort of went away thinking, yeah, this job is quite something. If nothing else, in these 2 years, yeah, moments like that. So yeah, I didn't spend a great deal of time with Jean-Claude Juncker. That was probably my one Jean-Claude Juncker story. And I'm sure others have got better stories.
And what do your colleagues make of him?
My colleagues make of him. Look, I think every politician, every political leader has their own way of doing things. You hear, you know, wildly different things about Juncker. I have no idea if some of the stuff that has been written and said is true. I've absolutely, you know, no idea, to be honest. But I also know for someone to, you know, to have got to that position, to have held that position, you know, you've got to be a smart operator. You've got to know your stuff. And he did. And I think he's probably one of those people who, you know, fell victim in many ways to the sort of Euro bashing that we see in large parts of the press, to be honest.
Because he's seen as, I mean, there are videos on YouTube where he appears, he's either very, very tired or he's on medication or he might have had a drink. And he's, you know, slapping people around the face. And, you know, his behaviour seemed quite bizarre, but maybe these are just rare moments in a compilation. This wasn't the norm.
I honestly don't know. I can only speak from the few moments that I've spent with him. And as I said, you know, when you know, the selfie moment was just a bit of humour. Yeah. You know, could have been anyone doing that, I suppose. It's just jovial sort of, you know, jovial bit of humour. But I don't know about the other stuff. I really don't.
And how accessible are the leaders of the European Union when you're a member of the European Parliament? I mean, obviously, in the final weeks, you're all chatting to each other because you're off. In more normal times, would a British MEP be able to meet the President of the Commission, the President of the Council?
Yes and no. You know, would you get a one-to-one audience for 2 hours to talk about, you know, some sort of niche issue you're working on? No, you wouldn't. But, you know, these people are around the Parliament, just in the same way that, you know, if you talk to Westminster MPs, they will say, you know, they will try and, you know, get hold of the Prime Minister or senior ministers in the course of voting when, you know, whenever they're around the House. It's a bit like that. you know, when the Parliament is sitting in full session for a plenary session, you know, President of the Council, the President of the Commission, the Vice President of the Commission, they're all around, they're all milling around the place. And, yeah, you can very easily, you know, have conversations, raise issues, you know, have your say with them. And, you know, for the most part, they are very good about that, and you know, have a recognition the Parliament is there to do a serious job. And you know, you get all this nonsense in parts of our media that the European Parliament doesn't have any power, it's just a talking shop. Well, you know, those commissioners, they can't get anything done without the say so of the Parliament. Every piece of EU legislation has to be approved by the Parliament. As an MEP, I could vote to veto EU trade agreements. A member of the House of Commons doesn't have any say on the trade agreements the UK is about to start signing round the world. So there had to be an inbuilt respect for the European Parliament and its members, and that led to, you know, the ability, even in a short period of time, to spend time with those people, have your say, get your view across. And certainly with Michel Barnier, he was always keen to engage with MEPs, and particularly the UK MEPs as well. As part of his work, he was always wanting to sit down, engage, hear what we had to say, sort of take the temperature, I guess, on what we were hearing in terms of you know, our political colleagues in Westminster or our constituents, businesses in the East Midlands, for example, who, you know, potentially would be huge implications for in terms of the different Brexit deal that may emerge for the, you know, huge parts of the East Midlands economy. So he was always keen to genuinely engage and listen.
What's the culture of the European Parliament like? You know, the cliches about Westminster are that, well, firstly, it's falling down, but that, you know, if you were to be unsympathetic, you'd say everyone's hammered. You know, the bars are cheap and the MPs are getting drunk, and there's this sort of culture down there that, to some extent, maybe even fosters a bullying aspect. But it's sort of seen as very boozy and in need of reform. What are the cliches of the European Parliament and its culture?
Well, certainly the European Parliament in Brussels sometimes had a feeling of falling down as well. A chunk of my office wall fell off once. There'd been no hot running water in the office building I was in for the entire period of time.
What?
I was there. There was no hot water. There was some big Legionnaires issue.
What?
Or something in the water system.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. So, you know, that's the gravy train for you. There's no hot running no hot running water in the and there still isn't. There still isn't. I have no idea when they're going to... anyone's ever going to get around to fixing this, but I found that a little bit not quite right.
No.
To be
these are the basics, surely.
Well, exactly. And there's, you know, journalists and blogs have written about the lack of hot running water in the European Parliament. But anyway, you know, the culture of the place, you know, I've spent time in Westminster just like, you know, you have as well, and it's different to that. It honestly is. It's very different. I remember my first day when I went to Brussels, and my office was up on the 13th floor. I was up, you know, in the office about 8 p.m. You know, I was working away, sorting things out, and I came down to the ground floor where there is a bar and there's a canteen and there's a sandwich shop and all that sort of stuff. And I came out of this lift, and the place is deserted. I'm literally the only person in the building. I was literally, where is everyone? Someone's not told me where to
the
go.
Party is.
But there isn't that culture in the Brussels Parliament that people will be in the Parliament until whatever time you drink. The bar in the Parliament sort of closes at 7 or 8. Of course, there's bars outside the Parliament where people will socialise. But, you know, this idea that it's all champagne receptions and the rest of it, that certainly wasn't my experience. In fact, I'm not sure I ever went to a single champagne reception. Maybe I just did it all wrong. Maybe I just got it all wrong. Maybe I just wasn't invited. I don't know. But yeah, I think, yeah, it can be that, I'm sure. But if you're there to do the job seriously, it's not that. And I think, like most political institutions, whether it's Westminster or the European Parliament, it's very easy to sort of, you know, characterise or caricature a certain culture.
I mean, it sounds like it's more professional than Westminster.
Yeah. I don't know if it's more professional. I just take the view that, you know, I spent most of my time with colleagues who were there to do a serious job of work, and that's what I spent my time doing. Of course, you know, you'd have a drink here and there with colleagues at the end of a long day, as you would in most sort of lines of work. Could you have spent a lot of time going to long boozy lunches if you'd have wanted to, probably, but you can do that in Westminster as well.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure there's a huge difference. But if you want to be noticed in the European Parliament, and if you want to get things done, you need to be noticed. It's a lot of hard toil behind the scenes. It's a lot of time spent in your committees in voting sessions, which would go on for 3, 4, 5 hours sometimes, literally voting on directives of hundreds of pages, line by line, sentence by sentence. And if you've got amendments down, you want to be there to make sure they get voted on. You know, the House of Commons sits every day that Parliament is in session. The European Parliament in full session doesn't do that. Our work is through the committees, and they are long, detailed meetings. You know, and if you're doing that right, if you're on two committees or three even, and you are involved in other sort of campaigns and informal groups working on particular issues and pieces of work, you know, there's not many hours left for the boozy lunches. I don't know if these boozy lunches exist or not. I certainly get invited to them.
So what about the role of an MEP back home then? Because for a Westminster MP, they cover roughly 70,000 voters. Even the most rural constituency pales into significance compared to a European region. How on earth do you prioritise where to go when you're covering the entire East Midlands?
Yeah, it's an absurd system. And, you know, many people talk about why turnout is low in European elections, why people don't know who their MEPs are, and that's because we have this absurd regional system. People don't live in regions. No one's ever said to me, you know, I live in the East Midlands. You know, you live in Nottingham, or you live in Leicester, or you live in Derbyshire. You don't live the East Midlands. It's a false construct for most people. So how do you prioritise? Well, I prioritised around issues. And of course, the predominant issue of my time as an MEP has been Brexit. So it's been spent time meeting businesses of all shapes and sizes in all different sectors. And the economy of the region is so dependent on that frictionless trade, on that close relationship with Europe. So I spent my time learning as much as I could, as quickly as I could, about what that meant in reality for those businesses. Huge multinationals, very small businesses in very specialist sectors, but nonetheless exporting to the EU27. So it's a huge geographic space, Skegness, right over to the edge of Manchester, North Nottinghamshire,
Skeggy,
all the way down to Silverstone and the southernmost tip of Northamptonshire. I did my best to get round all sort of corners of the region. I did, you know, if there was two or three Labour MEPs, you'd organise it differently. You'd probably focus in on a geographic area. You'd probably say, you know, you work on Nottinghamshire issues, you do Leicestershire. But I was one Labour voice. I like to think I did a reasonable job of getting around the region, but you'd always get people saying, you know, I don't know, you could be in Bolsover or Matlock or wherever, and people would say, oh, never heard of my MEP, you're never in the newspaper. Well, you know, it was like literally hundreds of weekly local newspapers. Yeah, you know, my staffing budget is pretty similar to that of a Westminster MP. And as you've said, a Westminster MP representing, you know, 70,000 people, also in a much more sensible geographic area, can have a team of 3 or 4 people in the, you know, across their staff. That's pretty much what I had to represent, you know, a huge chunk of the country.
Yeah.
And to be across many different issues, and you get casework and constituents inquiries just in the same way an MP would, not of the same volume, but you'd certainly get very complex cases that would require a lot of detailed work. It would, involve raising issues with European institutions, and as we've said, those institutions are huge bureaucracies in places. Just finding the right person to write to can be a lot of work.
So you become an MEP effectively mid-term. Do you? And I don't know whether you did take this decision. Say, right, well, I'm going to keep Glenys Wilmot's staff. Or do you go, right, I need to put my own stamp on this, I'm going to move to a separate office? What did you do?
I kept Glenys's office. It's in a building you know well, the East Midlands Labour Party building. Harold Wilson House.
23 Barrett Lane.
I have the ground floor of Harold Wilson House in Attenborough, just outside Nottingham. And that's an office of much history, because Glenys had it, previous MEPs had the office as well. So there's a great collection of Labour Party books, which you would love rifling through, I think.
Oh, I've rifled through, you know,
going back decades.
I used to work in the office upstairs for the East Midlands Labour Party, and I think I've taken a few bits of memorabilia over the years. The odd mug, the odd poster, but there is. It's got a remarkable...
It's a real treasure trove of of history in there.
Has it still got the video conferencing unit upstairs, which was like a big telly with a camera on top? I don't know if I've talked about this on previous episodes, but there was like a boardroom upstairs that the regional board would use. And it had this huge telly with like a camera on top. I remember when I first started working for the party, I was like, what's that? They said, oh, Noel Edmonds gave it us. And at the 2005 election, Noel Edmonds, who is well known as a Tory, bought a load of video conferencing gear and wanted to sell it to the Tory party cheap as a favour. And they were like, we don't need it. He's like, right, well, I'm going to give it to the Labour Party then. And we're like, go on then. So there was just this thing in the corner of the room.
I vaguely remember. I can vaguely remember this. Is it still there? I don't know. It might be in the corner of my office that I've just not sort of noticed. I don't know. But yeah, I took that office on from Glenys. I kept, I've had great staff these past 2.5 years who've gone through this sort of rollercoaster of uncertainty. As well, yeah, so some Glenys staff came to work with me, but over time, new staff have joined the team as well. And I know it's a cliche, every politician says this, you know, you can't do the job without a good team of staff.
But not every politician says it.
Well, I
the good
say
ones
it,
do.
I certainly say it, and I say it because it's the absolute truth. You can't do an effective job without a good team of staff doing, you know, important work. You know, unsung heroes. They're the ones who are answering the phone to constituents, drafting the letters, figuring out who on earth it is we need to find in the European Commission to raise this really serious issue for this individual. And it's a bit of the MEP's role that I don't think people necessarily appreciated. You know, I think people just thought we were off voting in Brussels and doing stuff there. But you know, there is the local and regional part of the role as well. And you know, I've had some, you know, very nice emails and letters these past few weeks from people that, you know, we have helped on some issues which have really, really mattered to them.
And how hard is it? Because at election time, so if you lose, it's the same for MPs, the MP just loses the job like that, and obviously we leave the European Union, the MEPs lose their job, so do your staff. I mean, it should be a nightmare for them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not been easy. I mean, I will say, and just going back to what we were talking about around the emotion and the tears in the parliament and all that sort of stuff, you know, we knew that day was going to come.
Yeah.
You know, although there were moments, certainly last autumn I felt it was a genuine moment or an opportunity that was giving some hope to a change of course. Just a tiny number of MPs in Westminster needed to change their mind on the idea of a confirmatory vote, and we could have secured that, but as we know, as soon as we were heading down the road of a general election, and it wasn't just when the exit poll came out on the night of the 12th, anyone who'd been out campaigning for Labour in the weeks of that campaign knew it was going to be catastrophic, and knew with that came the final nails in the coffin of the Remain or the confirmatory vote cause. So we knew this day and those weeks were going to come. So it hasn't really made it any easier, and certainly for our staff, they've had to look for jobs. It's, you know, had we left at the end of a mandate of the European Parliament, knowing there was a new tranche of MEPs coming in, there's opportunities for our staff in and around that. We haven't been replaced like for like. If you like, the Parliament has actually shrunk a little bit, so they haven't filled all 73 seats that we've vacated. Yeah, it's been a tough time for our staff because they've known we were approaching the end, but all the way through that, they've worked incredibly diligently and professionally and have, you know, just done a great job. And you know, take this opportunity to say thank you to all those staff who worked for Labour MEPs over this time.
And of your staff, the staff that works for you in your office in Nottingham, for those that wanted to seek further employment, have they been able to get jobs elsewhere?
Yeah.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, some have, some haven't. Some are still looking.
Okay.
And I'm doing what I can to help.
Yeah.
So anyone listening who's looking for very good, hard-working, diligent, multilingual people in Brussels, I can make some very good recommendations.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
It's just the role of the MEP for so many people is just unknown. People kind of get what a Member of Parliament does, particularly a constituency. Although, actually, to be fair, I'm already... I think most people don't even know what an MP does, actually. So an MEP... I always thought, when I was, you know, a Labour activist and started volunteering, whatever, I always thought the cushiest job's the MEP one, because there's not much accountability from the public. It gets kind of diluted across the region. Is that fair?
No.
Well, of course not, I suppose. I realise that now, but...
No, it's... I've described the job as misunderstood in many ways, and I think that misunderstanding comes from just the level of understanding of what we do. And as I said, the bulk of our work is done away from the glare of the media or the public at home. It is done in... You know, the Environment Committee of the European Parliament that is meeting on a Tuesday and a Thursday morning in Brussels, you know, people here are not watching that. I get that. But that doesn't mean we're not doing important work and voting on and passing legislation that is going to have a huge impact on people's lives. In terms of the accountability, as I said, I do find the regional system frustrating. I think some of that, you know, that doesn't help, you know, a notion of accountability, for sure, and the electoral system that is used, because I'm fully aware people are voting for a Labour MEP. They're not voting for Rory Palmer to be, you know, to be the MEP in the East Midlands. So there's almost a remoteness built into the system, which I found frustrating. That said, you know, if I look at my inbox when I was an MEP, there was no shortage of people trying to hold me to account, and as they should, for sure. The system doesn't help that relationship between MEP and the people they're representing.
Elected politicians also have the added pressure of not only going into politics and wanting to see the values and the principles you believe in enacted to improve people's lives. You represent a geographical area. You've also got to deal with staffing issues. All of a sudden, you're basically running a small business where you've got to deal with HR, wages, pay slips, any tension that might exist in the office. I mean, how do you go from, you know, being basically an activist to then effectively being a boss?
Well, I'd been in a political role before, so I'd managed a team of staff in my previous role at Leicester City Council. So I didn't find that a particularly dramatic change. But yeah, there's all these elements to the role. As you say, you are in effect running a small business. You're managing office budget, you're managing a team of staff, you're doing your own job as the elected representative. You have a lot of balls up in the air at the same time.
I beg your pardon.
It comes with the territory. But look, I haven't been an MEP. Has been, at a personal level for me, fascinating, a huge honour. It's been brilliant. I miss it enormously, and I don't just miss it. I don't miss it for me. I miss it for the fact that we as a country haven't got that seat at the table, that voice in those institutions, that influence at European level anymore. I've learnt a huge amount from it, made some great friends right across Europe, and as you say, there's huge amounts of these roles, whether it's in the European Parliament or in Westminster, or indeed, you know, if I think back to my days in local government, councillors. No one ever talks about the role of councillors, but these roles are, you know, I think what the public see is probably 5% of what we do.
Well, you're a councillor. You're also deputy mayor to the elected mayor of Leicester, Peter Soulsby, who I campaigned for in the disastrous Leicester South by-election of, I think, 2004, when we lost, when I say we, when Labour lost to the Lib Dems, Parmjit Singh Gill. That's when I chased Charles Kennedy around the constituency dressed as a chicken.
Still spoken about now on the streets of Leicester.
So being a deputy mayor, I mean, people, some people will know the difference between an elected mayor and a traditional council leader, where I think they're a good idea. They improve accountability. Everyone in the city gets a vote for the individual that runs the place. I think in cities where you do have a mayor, there is more recognition of the individual than, and I don't mean that in an ego way. People know who runs the city, and that's important. The role of a deputy mayor in London, which is the one that everyone compares it to, even though some London boroughs have mayors like Lewisham, there are numerous deputy mayors. There's a deputy mayor for housing, all this sort of thing. In Leicester, what was the model like?
Yeah, so Leicester moved to a directly elected mayor system in 2011, and Peter Soulsby was elected as the first mayor, appointed me as his deputy. I was a deputy for 6 years, so Peter decided at that time to have one deputy mayor and then a smaller team of assistant mayors who were the cabinet. Essentially, since I left, Peter actually decided to replace me with three people, which was, you know, need three people to replace me.
That's yeah, a compliment.
But you know, again, you know, a role that is quite difficult to define, I guess. You know, I spent a lot of time doing the meetings the mayor didn't want to do. But no, in serious, I had a fascinating portfolio. I was doing all kinds of things, climate change, transport, health, working with the mayor very closely on the budget, the financial strategy, on the big sort of economic regeneration programmes, getting investment into the city. So a fascinating role. And moving to the mayoral system has definitely been good for politics and democracy in Leicester, in my view, for sure.
And as a deputy mayor of a city like Leicester, how much change could you personally affect? Did you feel that actually this is better than being an MP? I can have far more effect on people's lives.
Yeah, you can make decisions on a day-to-day basis that we're going to change how frontline services were going to operate, how they were going to be delivered. You know, a stroke of the, not literally the stroke of a pen, because there was a few weeks' work went into it. You know, I decided that Leicester City Council should pay the proper living wage for its staff. I did that, you know, soon after the elections in 2011. And, you know, as a deputy mayor, I decided that was a good thing. That was something worth doing. Peter clearly supported that, and we just got on and we did it. And it's in a matter of weeks, and that, you know, literally changed how much our lowest paid staff were going to earn and take home in their monthly pay packets, and hopefully made a positive difference. So yeah, on any given day, you could make a real direct, tangible difference to people. But I would also argue, in a slightly different way, you could do that as an MEP,
yeah,
as well. Just in a different sort of way. You know, I would vote for a directive that would be concerned with the safety of meat, for example, you know, processed meat in burgers or sausages or whatever. You know, if that directive had not gone through, and that means the meat we're eating might be less safe for whatever reason, the fact that it has gone through and I've contributed to that in a small way makes a real tangible difference to people. It's different, but it's still there as an immediate impact on people's lives.
So you've been a councillor, a deputy mayor, a member of the European Parliament. Westminster's not the place that you've got to yet. Is that the next ambition?
I don't know, to be honest. I've just left this role, which I am honestly going to miss, which has just been, you know, the most brilliant job to have done, and to represent the Labour Party and the East Midlands, the region where I live, where I was born and brought up, where we learnt our politics in many ways. I don't know what's next for me, to be honest. There's a big, as you know, a very big, very important process going on at the moment, which will shape the Labour Party's fortunes in the future. And, you know, I intend to contribute to that a little bit in the next few weeks. And beyond that, I don't really know.
And what will your contribution be?
Well, I'm gonna do some campaigning for Keir Starmer. That's who I nominated, because one of the final things we were able to do as a team of Labour MEPs, we all had a nomination in the the leadership process. So all, you know, I had all the candidates on the phone and trying to persuade me to nominate them. And I thought long and hard about it. I spoke to a number of the candidates, but yeah, I feel Keir Starmer is the candidate who can best take us forward at this point in time. So I'm doing a bit of campaigning, encouraging people to vote for Keir. But I also tend to have my say on one or two of the issues that have dogged the Labour Party a little bit these past few years.
And just on the leadership thing, have you decided who you're going to vote for deputy yet?
I nominated Rosanna. I think it's got a huge amount to offer. She's brilliant. Really exciting candidate. Thank you. You had her on the live show.
She was out of this world.
Yeah, I didn't know her before this process. I obviously knew who she was and knew she was a member of Parliament. But I had about a 25-minute phone conversation with her when I was deciding who I was going to nominate. And yeah, she's got some great ideas, great energy. I think she'd be a fantastic deputy leader. I will also say that one of your other recent guests, Ian Murray.
Oh man, what a guy!
Has a huge amount to offer as well. And you know, whatever happens, you know, I hope that that Rosanna and Ian Murray have big roles to play in the sort of next phase of Labour's future.
One thing we haven't discussed, we've discussed every aspect, it seems, of the role of the member of the European Parliament, but being a Labour member of the European Parliament during this period. Firstly, what was the Labour European Parliament group's relationship like with the Labour leadership in your time?
Well, so our group leader, Richard Corbett, who is the leader of the European Parliamentary Labour Party, on our behalf, so spend a lot of time, would attend shadow cabinet meetings and NEC meetings. But yeah, I think it's fair to say my own experience that the leadership of the Labour Party, how to put this politely.
Oh, you don't have to be polite.
I might not be polite. I'm not necessarily sure they were that bothered what I, as a member of the European Parliament, was doing, to be honest. There were meetings with the leadership. There were meetings with people around the leader at particular points. But, you know, the leader himself, I'm not sure, was particularly engaged in what we were doing. Keir Starmer was. Was obviously out in Brussels a lot through in terms of the shadow Brexit secretary, and he spent a lot of time meeting with Labour MEPs and very, very genuine, very sincere, and was really, really good in engaging us in what he was doing in crafting Labour's Brexit policy. And as we know, that has been quite a delicate piece of work at times over the past few years. Tom Watson, when Tom was deputy leader, he was in touch often and was very interested in the work we were doing and very engaged and very supportive at a personal level, very supportive of me. John Ashworth, Shadow Health Secretary, came out to Brussels, did a big speech and met with a lot of the health stakeholders I was working with. So yeah, different levels of engagement, but I've got to be honest, you know, at the very top, I didn't feel a great sense of interest in what we were doing.
And in that final week, on that final day or since, have you had a phone call or a letter from the leader of the Labour Party thanking you for serving the party and the country in Europe?
We got a letter. It was sort of after the event, if you like, which, you know, I'm not, you know. Yeah, we got a letter. It was nice. there was no phone call. But look, you know, other members of the Shadow Cabinet on that day sent text messages, very nice, heartfelt, genuine, yeah, sincere messages to Labour MEPs. You know, I got a very nice text that morning from Keir, for example. And what a particular moment that day, that was the day of the vote, when I think it was a spokesperson, one of Jeremy Corbyn's spokespeople, had said, when asked what Jeremy would be feeling on the Friday, on Brexit Day, the point at which we leave, you know, he'll be shedding no tears. At that very moment, there were literally Labour Party politicians and staff and our team in Brussels literally shedding tears about what was happening. And I just, you know, that wasn't a deliberate slight at us. Of course it wasn't. But, you know, I think going all the way back to 2016 and the referendum, I still believe, and there's no point dwelling or crying over spilt milk, is there? I still believe if the Labour Party from the top had put more vigour, more energy, more passion into our part of the Remain campaign, the course of history could have been very different.
Is it fair to say that the group of Labour MEPs, in a way, was insulated from Corbynism, partly because of the electoral cycle, about when they're elected, partly the distance, partly the European issue? I mean, did you get the impression from colleagues who've been around longer, like Richard Corbett, that perhaps that group of people had not had the same numbers of, say, pro-Corbyn members of it?
Well, no, I mean, the EPLP that I joined in 2017, there were certainly some MEPs there who'd been very vocal supporters of Jeremy Corbyn, and I think had nominated him in 2015 and again in 16 as well. So there was always a range of views in the EPLP. In fact, right to the end, you know, you if you ask some of my EPLP colleagues at the end, they may well give you a very different take on the events of recent years. I can only give you my view, and you know, there's the what I will say at points in Brussels across the socialist family. There was certainly after the 2017 general election and the months following that, I got to the Parliament the October after the 2017 election. There was a huge amount of excitement around Corbynism amongst some of our socialist colleagues, and it was a little bit like the conversations you'd have here. You know, sometimes you go to a CLP meeting here a few months after the 2017 election, you'd have to remind people that we didn't win the election because it was being talked about and was developing this folklore almost that we'd won the 2017. And it was a bit like that in Brussels among some of our socialist friends and colleagues. And I remember Jeremy coming out to Brussels that autumn, and he, of course, met with the EPLP, but he also addressed some events put on by the Party of European Socialists. And you know, they were the same sort of rally. It was a rally type event, almost like an election rally. And I remember sort of looking at this event and thinking, you know, look, Labour's just lost a general election. At that point, what, the third successive defeat against an incredibly unpopular prime minister, against an incompetent, terrible Tory campaign. I just wanted to sort of say to my European friends and colleagues at that point, and I've successively said to them since, this is not the blueprint, red print, whatever. This is not the blueprint you want to be following necessarily.
So for Labour then and the future of the party, Keir Starmer, in your assessment, is the best hope Labour has to perhaps get close to winning ways again. It feels like in this leadership contest, I think Rebecca Longbelly's in a different place because she still kind of believes in the Corbyn project. But certainly for people who don't, Lisa Nandy and Keir Starmer, they can't really tell the party the truth about what's happened in the last few years. Do you think if Keir Starmer becomes leader, that will change a bit and you'll be able to say to them, look, a lot of that was just ludicrous?
I hope so. And like you, yeah, there's been times in this process when I've just sort of wanted people to let themselves off the leash a little bit. That's what it's felt like. And of course, you know, people are trying to win an election. I can understand why there has to be a degree of triangulation. We've all done that in selections and elections at whatever level. I guess after the process and when we've got a result and a newly elected leader, of course, the proof will be in the pudding. It'll be who do we see being appointed or unappointed,
fired
whatever from the shadow cabinet. You know, what's the composition of the shadow cabinet? What, you know, what proposals will come forward around renewing, reshaping the party machinery, for example? Because one of the things that I found most distasteful about these past few years, and I don't just say it because you used to be one, but it's the way we've seen Labour Party staff publicly criticised and hung out to dry. That just didn't used to happen.
Yeah, and you can't defend yourself.
And it
as a
didn't
minister.
Happen because it's just fundamentally wrong. It's not what the Labour Party should be about. It's not what any decent organisation employing people. And these aren't just jobs. Yeah. You know, this is, you know, I see how hard party staff work. They work just as hard, if not harder, than the elected politicians doing by-elections and, you know, constitutional stuff, and you know, raising money and just a huge plethora of stuff that the vast majority of Labour Party members just won't know about or have any appreciation of. And to see the party staff, the way they've been hammered at times, it's just been distasteful and wrong. And I just want the party to move on from that.
It was probably more a Westminster-focused debate, but particularly with the independent group, which was apparently formed this week, a year ago. How quickly things have changed. Was there, and I suppose there wasn't the same emphasis on MEPs leaving the party, or there didn't seem to be that discussion going on. But has there been a point at any point in the last few years, whether it was anti-Semitism or other things, where you thought, actually, I might leave the Labour Party?
So I've had conversations with my wife and many of us who, you know, have come from a particular place in the Labour Party, who've known the Labour Party in different times, you know, the sort of, I suppose, our era, our generation.
If the rock and roll years.
Well, just when it was so very different and we used to win elections and we weren't mired in horrific episodes of anti-Semitism. There's been times when I think many of us have found ourselves just utterly, utterly despairing of it. And I know the despair I feel about that is nothing compared to what Luciana and Margaret Hodge and Ruth Smith and people have felt. And I have nothing but admiration, real, genuine admiration. I don't know those people particularly well personally. I've followed this, you know, from inside the party, like many of us have done. But I've just moments of real despair, but honestly, moments of just sheer anger at what has happened. Real anger. The fact that, you know, I've been to constituency meetings and party events where you would raise concerns about what was happening. You'd just be shouted down. You'd be accused of making stuff up, and it was all, you know, it's all just some sort of proxy. For undermining the leader and the rest of it. It's been bleak and hard work, but I took the decision with others that actually we had a responsibility to stay in the party and to try to get the party back to a place where we were not just competitive in elections, but where we were just a decent place, where we were not talking about anti-Semitism. Now, realistically, we know there's some way to go, and hopefully this leadership process, one way or another, is going to be a critical turning point in that.
I can't believe I almost forgot to ask you about this. So there were two things I really wanted to ask you about, and I've only just remembered them right at the end. Firstly, you left a note in your office for presumably your successor. Now, politicians leaving notes because of Liam Byrne is a kind of risky thing. So what did the note say?
Yeah, so I left a note on the very final day, the Friday, Brexit day, just before I caught the Eurostar to come home. I just quickly jotted out, it's not something I pre-planned particularly, I was just sat in my office last half an hour. You know, it was a pretty bleak place, all the pictures off the wall, and you know, it was just in some boring office. So I thought, write a note. I've got no idea who's going to move into this office. So I just, you know, it was just, I can't remember what it said, to be honest. I think it just said, you know, very sad day. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, you know, I wish you well in this job. And I put it in the office drawer, and I just assumed that, you know, cleaners would come in and everything that we'd left in the office would just be cleared away.
Yeah. Incinerated.
I just didn't expect, you know, it to last. But I found out yesterday that it's a French MEP, French socialist MEP, has moved into that office and apparently has found the note and is very touched by it. I've not heard from her directly yet. She's apparently going to try and get in touch, but I heard from a, you know, a colleague via a colleague that the note had been found.
Amazing.
So there we go.
Well, we've got to try and get hold of her and get her on the show. That would be wonderful. And secondly, the scarves you had made. So there's a great image of the pro-European British delegation holding these scarves up on the final day. Where did you have the idea, and talk us through the entire process of designing it and getting them made?
Okay, the story of the scarves. I've talked about nothing else these past few years.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm talking about, you know, no one's asked me about, you know, what do I think about Canada Plus and trade and whatever else. I've just been talking about scarves. It's been... But anyway, yeah, the story of the scarf. So just before Christmas, when we knew Brexit was going to happen for sure, I thought, well, I just want to get a gift for friends and colleagues in the European Parliament.
Lovely idea.
Wanted to get something which would reflect the East Midlands region, my constituency. And the problem with that is there's nothing that's genuinely unifying. You know, if I went for something along the lines of Robin Hood, then you annoy Derby.
Yes,
if you get Melton Mowbray pork pies, you annoy Nottinghamshire. You know, just
and vegetarians.
And vegetarians. Stilton cheese. I didn't fancy taking a load of Stilton cheese in my suitcase on the Eurostar. So I thought, football, everyone talks about football and people like football. And actually, you know, you and I support the same football team. We've been, you know, we didn't know each other at the time. But I remember going to, I think it must have been 95, the European, the UEFA Cup run.
Oh,
Nottingham
my
Forest
God.
Against oh. Auxerre.
Yeah.
France. And I was going to that match with my dad. And on our way into the ground, we bumped into a big group of Auxerre fans. And between their French, our English, and some sort of broken communication in between, they wanted to swap scarves.
That's so cool.
So I said to my dad, look, swap your scarf because I want to keep mine, yeah. my own. So I've got this Auxerre scarf. I've still got it.
That's so cool.
So again, I thought, you know, football is this great unifying thing. So very quickly, I thought, football scarf, yeah, that's what we wanted. So
great
I
idea.
Sketched the design out with my daughter's felt tips about 3 days before Christmas.
No way.
Got a guy who worked in my Eastman's office at the time onto this and said, look, I want some football scarves making. I want proper woolen knitted scarves. I don't want some cheap printed thing. I want the proper real deal. So then just after Christmas, they arrived. And on one side, they say United in Diversity, which is the official motto of the European Union. We're 1973 to 2020. On the other side, just say Always United. And they're a half and half scarf. And I know this is contentious territory for football fans, but it was the only design that would really work for this
and
particular
it works
message
in this
and occasion.
Context.
Exactly. So I took them out to Brussels, started giving them out to my friends and colleagues. And they were, honestly, they were just done as a personal gift. They weren't done as, I know this is a strange thing to say, as a former politician, they were not done as a big sort of PR thing. I just expected people to pin them on the office wall or whatever. Yeah. People started wearing them. So I gave them to some of my German colleagues and friends, and they were wearing them around the parliament. And then before you knew it, people were knocking at my office door wanting them. The media were interested. Adam Fleming from the BBC did a piece on them. Sky News did a piece on them. The official museum of the EU, the House of European History, which is next door to the Parliament, wanted one. So I sort of presented one to them as well. So it just took off. And as you say, the pictures of certainly the pictures from the Socialist Group event where people were sort of waving them, sort of football, sort of terrace style. Yeah. And then also in the Parliament chamber after the vote as well. And I just genuinely didn't expect that. And I started to get emails and tweets, people wanting them and asking, you know, where could they get one? They're limited edition. There's not going to be some big mass run of them because I think there's something quite special about the fact that they were made for a very sad but historic occasion. And those who've got one know that they've got one of a batch, one of a kind. Yeah. And
you very kindly gave me one, which...
I did. And
like a Star Wars fan, I'm going to leave it in its wrapper. Like, you know, there's people who like leave the... Because I've got so much football memorabilia, I know you have as well, badges and autograph books and things. And it just, it sits as I'm very, very grateful that you sent me one.
So I've got the one that I had with me in the European Parliament at the moment of the vote and those very emotional moments after that have been all over the media. I've kept that one. Somewhere special. That's the sort of special one that I knew I
that's
had.
That's match worn.
That's match worn. That's the one. Yeah, that's, you know, I don't know, maybe.
It's like Gazza's Italian 90 shirt, isn't it? You cried in it.
I don't know. Yeah. Can you get scarves framed? I don't know.
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah. Of course you can get anything framed.
Maybe I'll get it framed. I don't know. Maybe it'll just go in the loft.
So how many did you have made?
300.
Oh, God, so quite a lot. Yeah, but I suppose in the global context, that's a limited run.
Yeah, once you've, you know, once I've dished them out to friends and colleagues.
It's cost you a fortune.
No, not really. Not really. But I was just pleased I did it because...
Such a cool thing to have done.
They became such a big part of this, you know, the visual.
It's the image of the day we left.
Yeah, and there was, you know, I thought other people might have done stuff. I thought people might have had badges made or something, but there was nothing else. And... You know, Richard Corbett, as I said, the leader of the Labour MEPs, I gave him his scarf at the start of that week and he just wore it for every meeting, every media interview he did through that week.
Such
and
a cool thing.
They just became, they just inadvertently, accidentally became a big a big part of the images of the moment.
I mean, really, you've become a fashion icon. You've become a fashion designer.
I think that's stretching it a little
bit. By default, but you've created a garment that everyone wants. It's a limited run. There's huge public demand for it.
Yeah.
You could do kind of political clothing. So, like, I don't know, whatever happens next, you could do
There's a niche market here, Matt, I think, and I think you're probably it.
I probably am, yeah.
For political T-shirts and scarves and socks and stuff. But yeah, they captured a moment. And I really didn't expect them to do that. I was a little bit nervous, actually, because they were done as a little gift for people. And I was a little bit nervous when they started appearing all over the media about... Because it just looked as if I was trying to almost exploit the moment. And yeah. I genuinely wasn't doing that. I genuinely didn't do this for... there wasn't a press release that went out saying, I've had these scarves made or whatever. They were just done as a gift.
Available on the website, $10.99. Could have made a fortune out of these, mate.
Well, I've auctioned a few off. I'm in the process of auctioning the last few off in support of the Joe Cox Foundation.
Great
because
idea.
People, as I said, people right across Europe, right across the country, were getting in touch wanting one. And, I had a few spare and I just thought, well, what's the fairest way of doing this? So I thought, well, raise a few quid for a good, important cause.
Brilliant. And just finally, absolutely finally, deep down, in truth... Do you think there'll ever be a sort of serious movement to rejoin the European Union in your political life?
Yes. My heart immediately says yes to that. My head is tempered a little bit with, there has to be a degree of pragmatism about this. But I genuinely think that in our lifetimes, I think the question will be asked again. I think there is a very important strategic question about how you build that campaign, and if it goes too soon, too quick, it will fail dramatically again. And this has to be about the sort of moments that lead there. And for me, the first moment is electing the right leader of the Labour Party, making sure the Labour Party doesn't lose its sense of pro-Europeanism. I fear we did do that the past few years. We've got to rediscover that. We've got to develop and articulate what that means from outside the European Union. But at some point, I think that question will be asked again. I think the country will, elements of the country and parts of the population will look for a progressive pro-European political party. And if it's not the Labour Party, it will be someone else.
What a fantastic note to end on. Rory, thank you so much for coming in. This has been amazing.
Thank you.
There you go, Rory Palmer. I can't believe I've known him 20 years, maybe more. It's so cool to think back, I mean, I wonder who else was in those rooms that's gone on to do wonderful things. There have been other people there that have gone on perhaps to be in the shadow cabinet or wherever. You never know exactly when you're at these events who else is there. But I really remember Rory from the very early on. And I think it's fair to say, and I'm sure you'll share this assessment, he has got a lot of road left to have a glittering political career. Really, he's only really at the start, I think. But what a brilliant perspective he brings to things, and what a brilliant attitude. And you can just tell how sad the whole thing is for someone like Rory, who wanted to stay in the EU, not just because he was there. I mean, if anything, that all sounded quite secondary. It was just the sadness, the reality for those of us who voted Remain. Or should I say, for some of us who voted Remain, you have found that quite emotional. So, and those scarves, they're going to be collector's editions. They're the sort of the try and get your hands on one. I don't know if he would give you one if you tweeted it. Or maybe you can buy one at auction, as he says, to raise money for the Joe Cox Foundation. But what a fantastic guest. And it's one of those, it was like having Greg on last week, where you go, you don't have enough people who do politics in that way. So I think actually, as well as European level, local politics is just a different world. So I shall endeavour to try and get more local politicians on the podcast in the future. Thanks as always for downloading this. If please you could share it on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, wherever else you find your friends in person, just tell people about it. And if you could leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to this, the one thing it really helps is for other people to find it. And it would be great if as many people as possible could listen to the show. You can also email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com, as people do. So thank you all for all your lovely emails, whether they're reflections on previous guests, whether they're suggestions for future guests, or whether, like Toby, who got in touch, you found some Nottingham Forest programmes in a charity shop in Buxton and wondered whether I wanted them picking up. I studied the photo he sent me in detail. I think I've got all of the ones that he suggested. I inherited a load when my granddad sadly passed away. But if you see any political or football memorabilia you think I might like, then email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. And as always, it's nice to know where people listen. Thomas Ware dropped us a line and said he is listening to the show in my kitchen in Fulbourne in Cambridgeshire while cooking a lovely roast chicken. Oh, what a life, mate. That's what you want to hear about. I listen to podcasts while I cook as well, so that's very cool to know that other people do while listening to this. So it doesn't have to be exotic. It doesn't have to... Well, but if it is, do let me know. politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Tickets for Brexit Pursued by a Bear and the Political Party you can get through my website, mattford.com/live. I'll see you next week. And as always, thank you for downloading. Ta-ra.